Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Artificial intelligence is everywhere. It's editing our documents, pretending to be customer service agents, even taking our drive-through orders. But what about fashion magazines? Are we ready for AI to generate its version of human beauty? Carl Axel Wallström founded Swedish Copy magazine in 2022. The fashion magazine is the first to feature exclusively computer-generated models. Here's Carl Axel discussing his inspiration.
I realized that I need to do something for an audience, and fashion magazines always sort of covers the present, and they're really sort of on trend. So I thought that the fashion magazine would be an ideal sort of forum and also a title to portray generative AI. But I think also it was an urge to get the technology in the physical form, because generative AI was, and I think still is, kind of a computer person hobby, in that sense that it's a lot of men who are sort of using these softwares, and I think also the content is often reflected from a male sort of point of view. And I wanted to sort of to prove sort of how imaginary and how creative this new technology is by making a physical publication, because then my hopes was that I could reach another type of audience and to sort of open other people's minds and to spark some sort of interest in generative AI.
Carl Axel faced limitations, though, that would be expected from a source designed primarily by one kind of person. This has been a conversation ongoing about AI and facial recognition. If the data we give it only shows certain kinds of people and faces, how inclusive will generative AI be? Instead of letting that dissuade his pursuit, he looked at it from a different point of view.
But we have to also understand that generative AI and Copy Magazine is sort of sprung out of a technology, and a technology that is based on generative AI models. And models is huge data sets that contains a lot of hundreds and millions of images. And so when I did the first issue of Copy Magazine, those previous models, they were quite limited. And so they were trained on sort of a quite stereotypical data from and on what fashion is. And I realized this quite early. Like, I did, for example, some testing where I sort of tried to push the limits, but generative AI didn't, for example, it didn't even understand how a curvy body figure looked like. And I mean, for us people, that's something that's a no-brainer, but for the generative AI back then, it was just impossible. And what I thought was interesting about that, instead of just getting mad and angry, was that this is a reflection of what we have been doing as an industry for so long time. So it was almost like it felt just so natural to sort of make a statement with Copy number one, to sort of just show what's been wrong with the industry, what's wrong with how we are portraying fashion and style, so that we could get a discussion.
Carl Axel Wallström's Copy magazine is the first to feature AI models, but it probably won't be the last. Joining us now to talk about the future of artificial intelligence and fashion is Laird Borelli Person, the senior archive editor at Vogue. Welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me, Anna.
So when you spoke to Carl Axel about Copy, he talked about something that he mentioned in our conversation too, which is that AI doesn't always have an accurate representation of either exactly what fashion is or what humans in all shapes and sizes look like. How do you think where do we go from here if AI only has one idea about what we look like?
I think this is a bigger question about where we are in culture. There was an excellent article in the New York Times, Arts and Culture, about the sort of rate of change slowing down from, for example, from the 50s to or the 30s to the moon launch. And then I think we're in a period of nostalgia and recycling. I think we need to be very much aware of the biases that are coming, with using existing information. And that was one of the really interesting things that came out of my conversation with Carl Axel, because working with the archive and working with contemporary things, for me, past and present are always intertwined. But, we just assume, I think, because AI seems like such a new technology. I mean, it has been around, just not,
At this
activated
level of
as much.
saturation, yeah.
But, we are dealing that the information it has is not future information. But I do think that it's changing really rapidly. Even, a simple Google search will, result in you have quicker, faster, AI answers. So I think being aware of this is super important from the start. And I do have hope that it can and will change rapidly.
I grew up, I came of age at the time that we were seeing backlash to Photoshop, right? The idea that we were removing pores and trimming waists and hiding wrinkles and creating this unattainable, unreal style of beauty. And there was a real backlash to it. But I sort of wonder, I don't know, it almost feels, I don't know if dangerous is the right word to say that we're going to just start fabricating whole humans. Or the potential for danger there, because it truly could be unattainable because they don't even exist.
They don't. I have to say, my personal experience of experiencing Copy Magazine came on a Sunday afternoon living room couch, and I was so shattered. I was so shocked, and I remain shocked because the mind is fighting against the eye, and we have come long ago to accept that what we see, we assume is real, and you have to really backpedal. And I'm looking at these people, and I know that they're not real people, but they're indistinguishable from new people. And I'm reading the captions, and I'm saying, I know it's an AI magazine, but I'm thinking, why don't I know who this designer is? Have I missed out on something? And then also, I'm thinking, is this all we are? Is fashion, can a fashion magazine be reduced to five stereotypes and, one or two chirpy tones, of language? And I called Carl Axel, and I was like, is this all we are? Please tell me there's more. So I still, it's still reverberating, and I still find it shocking. And I don't know how to correct, and I was really fighting it, how to correct that perception and knowledge gap. It's so difficult.
Yeah, I think about, we see a lot of AI generated images, particularly on social media, of homes in just unbelievably beautiful settings or like wrapped in nature in ways that like look too beautiful to be real. And a lot of times they are. They're enhanced or they're AI creations. And I sort of wonder at a fashion magazine if there's a risk of creating designs that couldn't actually be created in real life, if that makes sense.
Yes, I mean, designers, I've talked to several designers about this. For example, Kalina Strada did a collection, I believe, 2 seasons ago by feeding the AI photos of her designs and seeing what came out. In Denmark, Helliot Emil did the same. And they found that the AI did suggest things that aren't possible, like hands with more fingers than we usually have. It didn't seem to have a good at that time a good grasp of the physicality of the figure. But as Carl Axel says, it has said in our conversations, it's also a work in progress. So you put it in and you get a three-sleeve shirt and you say, oh, that's not what I wanted. But maybe the way that the shadow falls from the third sleeve gives you an idea. And so I think ideally you're in a conversation, you're being prompted to, you're being surprised with things that you don't expect that spark a new idea. And I think, as I said, in an ideal scenario, this is pushing you to innovate because you are unable to control the result and so are continually surprised. What I'm interested, Anna, and I was talking to Carl Axel about this morning, is what will AI do to language? While many people prompt with images, Stina Goya, for example, a Danish designer, she had her press release written by ChatGPT, and she created prints. And some of the prompts, don't quote me exactly, were like rose in ice winter, and came up with these kind of abstract florals. But if the more people play with AI, how will it change our everyday language? I see that students in graduating from fashion school, some of them have stopped using capitals on their name. I asked, is this a thing? No one really had an answer, but someone suggested it's because it's kind of like DM and text language. You don't use, proper grammar and punctuation. And we have, of course, there are, lingo for every generation, but what will it do to language when prompts are, not sentences necessarily?
Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways, computers are more literal. So learning how to talk to artificial intelligence is definitely a skill. Like, there are whole jobs with six-figure salaries for people who can figure out the best ways to interact and talk with AI to get the things that you want. But it will, at least for now, be a different style of communication. I do wonder if one day it's going to get smart enough to talk just like us.
Or maybe it could be like a Ferlinghetti style, jazzy sort of poetry language. I don't know. I did want to mention also another interesting, I should say I'm not a tech expert by profession, but very interested to see how people are playing with this in fashion. And Norma Kamali is always interested in longevity. And she's taken this interest. She's written a book on it. She has products, beauty products, wellness products, but she's also taken it into the idea of legacy. So training an AI to learn how she designs so that
Oh my
the
goodness.
company can carry on, in her wake
Yeah.
using AI, which is completely fascinating idea, especially in this case because Norma's clothes are so influential and so she does the same designs that she did from the 70s. I mean, she might tweak them, she'll do them in a different fabric, but already she's the parachute dress is there, and so this is really, really fascinating about what it can learn. And I had a conversation with Nick Knight, the photographer and organizer of Show Studio, like could an AI, he was suggesting like learn how he looks at a camera, what his height is, what angles he prefers. Is that scary or not? I guess it depends on who's looking at. But yes, I think there's also a larger question when you're talking about fashion is it is about fantasy to a large degree. So where do you draw the line? Is it retouching? Is it AI? I think I want to say in Norway that I think there was, don't quote me, but I think there was a law passed that you have to say if something's retouched. There's a lot of interest in this. And yesterday there was the news that was it the Surgeon General suggesting that
The warning. Yeah,
in
we're going to be talking
yeah
about
the
that later
warning.
this hour. Yeah.
But like who gets to decide where who decides what fantasy is and what the limits of it are. In a way.
Yeah. So Dove, actually. So I think a lot of brands are going to have to grapple with this. So Dove's Real Beauty campaign launched about 20 years ago. And the CEO recently told Fox Business that the company won't be using computer-generated models in any of its advertising. CO said that we seek a future in which women, not algorithms, get to decide and declare what real beauty looks like. So there are people putting their stake in the ground against this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's extremely fascinating and scary, but also sort of interesting. I recently, through my son, got into anime. So I live with, you know, imaginary friends every night, and I can be a pirate if I want. But because it's not realistic, it's okay in a different. You know what I mean? It's accepted because it is it's fantasy because it's not trying to replicate something real.
Yeah. I want to circle back to something that you said earlier, because Dove also surveyed 2,000 people about their perceptions of beauty. And what I found really fascinating was that 1 in 3 reported pressure to alter their appearance because of what they see, even when they know it's generated by AI. So it's kind of like what you were saying earlier, looking at the magazine. You know they're not real, and yet you can't help it.
They look real, and you no matter how much I force my mind, I'm still looking at someone that looks real, and I can't cancel it out. My brain isn't louder than the eye somehow. It was a very jolting experience. And I have to say, the brilliancy, I think, for me, of the first issue of Copy, the only life rope that I got was in some of the copy for a beauty feature that was kind of like, if you buy this cream or something, of course your life will be better. And that was, it was so, there was some hint of like humanity and or humor or snarkiness in that, and it just gave me like, oh, okay, like it's not all preaching the gospel that this is right. There is some inherent criticism, and I really needed that because I was so disoriented, and I remain disoriented. And Carl Axel was showing me the spreads from the second issue, and one of his comments, he did a spread on the idea of Karen's personality type, and he said that the AI in his experience was very up on internet culture. And again, I come back to language. I'm not a TikTok user, but I do wonder, is Tomato Girl Summer and Latte Girl, are these trends that people are seeing, or are these trends that are a cute phrase that that people find evidence to support? The chicken and the egg to me seems to be always in question. Where is it coming from? A sound of something, a sound of two words or three words, or actually something that's happening? And as I said to Carl Axel this morning, the volume of fashion and imagery that's out there that you can, if you really want to, you can kind of prove almost any trend that you want to. I still believe that there are tendencies that are more than other tendencies. I do trend reports, and there are directions that are stronger than others, but you can always find a boho story if you want it. You can always find, name it, wash denim. It will be out there. It just might not be the main push of what designers are doing.
That was Laird Borelli Person, the senior archive editor at Vogue magazine. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Anna.
Coming up, why a Maryland correctional institution teaches inmates, I cannot talk this morning, how to repair virtual cars. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. If you want to teach someone how to change a car's oil, replace its brake pads, check its battery, the logical thing to do would be to get them a car and learn, right? Get your hands dirty. Well, the folks over at the Maryland Correctional Institute are teaching inmates how to be mechanics virtually, donning VR headsets where they learn mechanical basics on virtual cars. Danielle Cox is the Director of Education at the Maryland Department of Public Safety, and she joins me now to talk about how to be a virtual reality mechanic. Welcome to All Sides, Danielle.
Thank you for having me, Anna.
Also with us is the Director of the Ohio Department of Youth Services, Amy Ast. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Anna.
So, Danielle, I'd like to start with you. How did Maryland find out about this virtual mechanic program from Vehicles for Change?
We have had a longstanding relationship with Vehicles for Change. They have worked with our partners at the Maryland Department of Labor that offer our career and technical education hands-on programs behind the fence. So all of our automotive programs, diesel programs, where the men and women will get trained behind the fence, hands-on in those spaces, and then able to connect either during work release or post-release with Vehicles for Change to either get employment or continue their apprenticeship program post-release. So that longstanding partnership, when they started the virtual reality, we were the first person they came and asked.
And so what's the benefit of doing virtual reality as opposed to hands-on learning in a traditional setting? Is it safety, increased number of participants? Is it cheaper? Is it all of the above?
All of the above. One of our biggest reasons for doing it, especially at our women's facility, is we just do not have the space. One of the things across the nation that we are seeing is space is an issue, especially when we're talking about educational programs. We're trying to pack as many programs in there as possible. And to have an automotive program with a lift and everything that that takes is a massive amount of space. Funding, safety, security, having to make sure all the tools and equipment is secure. So being able to take and just put an Oculus on your head and have a tiny little circle in a classroom that you stand in was a huge advantage for our program.
Amy, I want to bring you in now. So the Ohio Department of Youth Services is working to bring this VR training to youth facilities here in Ohio. Can you tell us what the program is going to look like?
Yeah, thank you. We are so excited about this technology. We have a partnership with another state agency, Ohio Job and Family Services, and they're providing the funding for us to purchase these virtual reality headsets through an organization called Transfer. And Transfer is already connected to Ohio Means Jobs. And we have certified Ohio Means Job centers in each of our three high schools in our state facilities. So that partnership already existed, and as a way for continued career exploration and even further certification and skill training, we're excited about this. Our youth are also so excited about this. And I agree with Danielle, like space is so critical when you're trying to do career readiness, and to be able to do this virtually and to do it with a population of youth who are already tech savvy. And very tech literate, this is just going to be a game changer for them.
Do you have any sense of when you might launch this program?
We're hoping to have it launched by the end of this year. I don't think there's going to be any concerns with that. We're working on solidifying the partnership with JFS and getting the funding secured. And then once we get the actual headsets, you know, the next step will be for our IT department to make sure that goes along with our secure, IT work where, you know,
there's just like the logistics.
Absolutely. So once all that is in place, we'll be excited to launch this, but I expect we'll be able to do it by the end of this year.
Danielle, I have to ask, because I was a little thrown at first when this idea was presented to me of learning how to repair a car in virtual space. Have any of the women in your program graduated or been released? Like, have you gotten feedback from employers? Like, does changing virtual oil translate to changing the oil in an actual car?
Absolutely. We are actually in our third cohort. So we've had two cohorts of women that have graduated and gone on. I believe five of which have been released, the other five that are working work release with Vehicles for Change to go through that process to get that hands-on, finish that apprenticeship. With the virtual reality, they get three certifications with the Automotive Service Excellence as ASC. So that gives them an opportunity to, like you said, learn how to change oil, and they actually become certified oil change mechanics. So that means that they could go out, get a job at like Jiffy Lube or an auto dealership or something like that, working in like where you go and take your car to get an oil change and do those type of jobs. Or they could take, and if they have more time behind the fence, do the work release and do the automotive apprenticeship where they get the full range and they can actually get that higher paying job. We're seeing actually employers, especially with the women, they really want them because they pay, I hate to say it, sorry, men, a little bit more attention to detail when it comes to kind of those little things. So employers are really seeking the women to actually come and do these, be employed in their organizations.
I got to ask, did it feel strange or maybe even a little silly for some of them until like they put the headset on and started the classes?
Absolutely. We actually had a couple women that were very apprehensive and were thinking about not even taking it. So what we did is we had Vehicles for Change and their trainers come in first and actually just show them what it looked like. They showed them up what they would see. They had them put them on, get kind of used to it and acclimated to it. And after a while, they were having a great time. Even the instructor in the videos, they nicknamed him. And they really did. They had a great time getting it. And some of the stories at graduations, we had all the women speak about what this meant to them. And just as a really quick story to tell you, we had a woman, she's in her 70s, who went through the program. She said she didn't do this to get out and get a job. She's being released and she wanted a connection to her sons and her grandson to be able to teach them how to do it and have something they could do together. I thought that was a great story.
You know, Amy, I was wondering what kind of training programs do you hope to have at the Department of Youth facilities?
Well, we currently certify youth now in industry credentials. So they can get certified in a welding certification, ServSafe, Ramtech Robotics, and we have a lot of success with our youth getting those credentials. And certainly there's I think last year we had close to 1,300 skill certificates that our youth were able to really invest in. But what this is going to do that's different is virtual reality engages all the senses, right? With virtual reality, it really is like an immersive experience. And we want our youth to not just do credentialing and certificates because it's an option. We want them to find what kind of career matches up to their interest. Hmm. And this immersive experience is going to connect them not just with the ideas they have about what they want to do, but what those interests are. And I'll give you an example. So we have some young people that say, you know, Director, I want to be a plumber, or I'm going to get my certification so I can be a lineman. But until they have that virtual experience, they might not know that they don't like tight spaces, right? Or maybe they have an interest in going and working as an electrician, but until they have that immersive experience, they don't know, they're afraid of heights, right? So by tapping into all these senses, it's really going to open up a world and opportunities for them that will really help narrow what their interests are, what jobs that are available in Ohio that are high demand, that match up to their interests, provide them skills, so that they can move forward and up in their career. And at the end of the day, we want them to be able to be independent, right? When they return to their communities, we want to really create pathways where they have success as they return to the community.
Oh my goodness, I hadn't thought of it, but that sounds It sounds like internships that you take in college, right? You take classes, you take internships, you get a sense of whether this is for me. And it sounds like you're saying, Amy, that the virtual reality will allow them to try on a bunch of different careers to see which one fits.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. And Lisa, we have a lot of success in our Buckeye United School District. So each of our three state facilities have high schools. And in fact, just this past couple of weeks, I've attended three high school graduations where 44 young men received their high school diploma, which was almost double what we had last year, and 34 youth with their GED. So we understand the significance of not only education, but career readiness. So our youth have tremendous success when they leave our DYS facilities the first year they're released. And nearly 86% of them don't recidivate. So they don't come back to DYS facility and they don't enter the adult prison system. And then after year two, that percentage drops a little bit. And then year three, it drops a little bit more. And we know with each year that they're out, they get older, right? So we know that education and a career path is essential to continuing to lower recidivism rates. So we're not looking at this virtual reality as, an option to fill time for the kids that we have in DYS. We really are interested in driving long-term change. And when you can provide opportunities for them to really be immersed in some of these career options, I think it really is, and I said this earlier, it's going to be a game changer for our kids.
Danielle, I wonder if you see it as a game changer too for the adults in your system, but maybe one day used in Maryland's youth system as well.
Absolutely. I have to give credit to our secretary, Carolyn J. Scruggs, for allowing this to happen in the first place. You know, her whole goal for the department is to ensure that our incarcerated individuals are leaving incarceration better than when they arrived. In addition to our governor, Wes Moore, who gives us that support to leave no one behind. And that includes these transformative programs for our incarcerated population who are going out into the workforce and into our labor market. And they are this population of people I don't think that we really look at as, hey, we need to make sure that we give them those skills so that they can go out and get those jobs and be able to be successful, productive members of society. And they want to be. These are your best workers. We talk to our employers and they will tell you that they are their best workers. And actually, our youth detention centers, our Department of Juvenile Services is actually currently working with Vehicles for Change to do a memorandum of understanding to bring this also behind the fence, because they saw how transformative it was for our women. And we are looking also to expand into multiple other facilities that don't have the hands-on programs that we can help give them something before they get released. Absolutely. And I love what he was saying about the youth. We are seeing a massive explosion of youth coming into our prisons. So to be able to give them that, like she said, it's something they are used to, that technology, right? Some of the older women, it took them a little bit longer to get used to, but the kids, they pick
digital natives,
so quickly. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, for them, it's probably not weird at all to put the headset on and suddenly right. be up a telephone pole, like repairing a power line. Amy, I wonder, I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, but I wonder if the inverse is true for you as well. As you're getting this program off the ground for the Department of Youth Services, whether the adult prison system is kind of, watching what you guys are up to.
I hope so. But I have to tell you, our partnership with the Department of Rehab and Correction is awesome. In fact, their superintendent of schools used to be our superintendent of schools here at DYS. So we have great collaboration. They connect us to resources. We connect them to resources. So I expect this will be something once we launch, they'll be very interested in.
I will tell you that I know who that is. We all connect those directors of education, and she is very interested in bringing this to Ohio. Yep.
So it sounds like virtual reality training inside prisons may just become the new normal in 5 to 10 years.
Right.
I certainly think it will for DYS facilities for the reasons that we already mentioned. But I mean, we're also You know, and it's true probably for the adult system as well. There is a national crisis in staffing. And you know, we used to take youth off campus a lot, and we're really limited. Last year we took about 10 kids off campus. Six of them graduated from Cuyahoga Valley Career Center, where they were certified in HVAC basics and heating and cooling and electrical, and passed an EPA certification exam. But when kids go off campus to career centers to get that, it's additional staff resources. So we don't do near as much of that as we did before COVID. So that's another reason why I think it's so valuable to us, is that the kids are going to be able to get that hands-on experience through the virtual reality experience.
And if I might add, we're seeing a huge revolving door. I'm not sure about you in that youth system where it's they're in, they leave for a couple months, they're back in, right? If we can get them that certification, get them that skill to keep them out and hopefully also out of our adult prisons, that's the goal, right?
That was Danielle Cox, Director of Education at the Maryland Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Absolutely.
And thanks to Amy Ast, Director of the Ohio Department of Youth Services. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, should we put a warning label on social media similar to the one we have for cigarettes? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver. Every pack of cigarettes sold comes with a warning. Smoking can cause cancer. Now America's Surgeon General wants to add that label to social media sites, warning younger users that these apps can cause mental health problems. Devorah Heitner is an author and social media educator. Her latest book was titled Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in the Digital World. She joins us now to talk about whether social media should come with a warning. Welcome back to All Sides, Devorah.
Thank you.
So, what did you make of Surgeon General Vivek Murthy's call for these warning labels? He wrote this op-ed and then released it into the wild, essentially, because Congress is going to be the one to have to enforce it.
Well, I love a lot of his suggestions, and he really does talk about other things, right? So the labels he acknowledges in the op-ed that the labels aren't really sufficient, and I would agree, and I have some concerns about the labels and some of the negative sides of labeling something that, unlike cigarettes, does not have universally negative impacts, right? The Surgeon General's own report just in 2023 was very measured and really talked about the ways social media can have both benefits and risks for kids and teenagers. Right. So we know this, and so has the American Psychological Association and other people who have studied this come back repeatedly with the data, which shows that it's a mixed bag, that social media has the potential for some risks and downsides and harms and has benefits in belonging and community. Right. So much of it depends on who you are, who you're following on social media, how much time you're spending on social media. But cigarettes are not like that.
No, there's no
cigarettes are bad for your health.
Yeah, there's no safe way to smoke a cigarette.
Exactly, right. Whereas if I'm just checking my messages for a couple minutes every day on Instagram and looking at one really awesome YouTuber that I follow, I'm not experiencing downsides and risks of social media, especially if I'm balancing it with other aspects of my life, if I'm getting outside, if I'm seeing friends in person. So I would like to see if there is going to be messaging. Have it be focused on, hey, have you shown your parents some of the people you follow? Or, hey, are you getting outside today? Or, hey, is it getting late? Are you getting your sleep that you need? If we are going to put messages into social media, it should be about using it in a balanced and thoughtful and empathetic way? Am I being kind with what I post, as opposed to just, this is going to hurt you? Because I think that's misleading and could make people also feel like giving up. It could disempower parents. They could feel like, oh, it's so bad for my kids, I don't even know what to do, as opposed to, oh, I could help my kids with this.
I wonder then if we should not compare it to cigarettes, but think about it in terms of alcohol, the like drink responsibly.
That's an interesting comparison, because for some people, alcohol is a never, right? Like for some adults
yeah.
who are in recovery or have other health issues, there it may be a never. And you can have a good life without drinking alcohol. And I think you can have a good life without social media. I'm not sure you can have a career in many areas without having any online presence. Like if you want to go to like not having email and not checking
yeah,
your
that's
work
probably
Slack,
too far. Yeah.
You know, even if you're in agriculture, you've probably got to check your farm's Slack or your email, right? For your suppliers. And this is where I feel like full abstinence for in terms of online and digital communities is not really the goal with kids. It's not like we're trying to teach them to never be connected online. And that's where I feel like we need to teach digital wellness. There's a lot of evidence that shows that kids who talk to their parents about their experiences online, who have good models at home, are having a more positive experience.
Yeah, Dr. Murthy makes the point in that New York Times piece that adolescents who spend more than 3 hours a day on social media face double the risk of anxiety and depression. And the average daily use in this group as of last summer was almost five. It was 4.8 hours. So I think it is a little bit to harken back to that like alcohol analogy, like, you know, one or two drinks an hour is fine, five or six, maybe not. Like it's about how long and how much you're consuming.
Well, and we have an age limit for alcohol, and like we have an age limit for driving and other things. And we, especially with driving, we also do training, right?
That's
so
true.
Unfortunately, we don't have a training class for, you know, that maybe we should. I taught on a college campus, and I think perhaps people should be taught how to drink responsibly. But college, you know, that's a different situation. But driving is a situation where we teach. My son is 15, and he's doing the 30 hours of classroom ed. And then he's going to need to do 50 hours of supervised driving with me and my husband. And then he needs 8 hours with an instructor on the road. That's a significant amount of mentorship. I do think kids need mentorship to do social media. I don't know if they need, you know, 80 specific hours of like dedicated class just on Instagram. But do I think we should hand it over to kids at 13 and be like, go for it, have fun? I don't. Just like teaching a kid to ride their bike in the street, you want to make sure they're wearing a helmet, make sure they know the rules of the road. The first time my kid, when he was, you know, 10 or 11, wanted to go somewhere outside of our neighborhood on a bike, I was like, you go, but I'm going to follow and make sure you're doing it right. Or you're going to go together and we're going to plan the route together to see what's the safest route. Now that he's 15, he can bike all over our town and I trust him to make safe decisions. But it's a graduated process. And I think parents would be parents want to thoughtfully tune into teaching kids to have more and more responsibility as they get older, not just handing over everything at the beginning. And make sure that they're also modeling thoughtful use themselves. I don't want to be texting and driving in front of my new driver. Maybe we don't want to be, you know, checking our phone at dinner if we don't want our kids to we don't want to see that behavior in our own children.
Yeah, I kind of love that idea of there's so many things, whether it's like cooking, cleaning, laundry, even making their bed, right? There's so much of parenting is modeling how to do something, teaching that to them, and then slowly stepping back and letting them chart their own course. And we don't often consider that with social media, that probably is the way to go, especially because I was born in the 80s, and you know, my parents got an AOL, like, you know, CD in the mail, and we dialed it up and we went with it, and they didn't even know what it was, let alone me, right? There were no rules of the road when I was figuring it all out.
I think that's what the challenge is now. And what I hope for, if there are going to be warning labels, and again, I have some concerns, and I'm just also curious, like, where do these, are they when you sign up? Are they every time you use the app? But
every hour that you're on.
Right. If the warning labels bring parents and kids into a conversation, I do think that would be a positive. What we want to see is parents talking with their kids, including just not spying on their kids, but asking their kids, hey, who are you following? Is that person making, you know, uplifting you and inspiring you, or are they bringing you down? What are the experiences that we as adults have had feeling left out when we look at social media? How can we help our kids navigate that? How can we help our kids navigate conflicts that might come up even in texting, but especially in the social media comments. If you look at YouTube channels or the way people talk to each other in Snapchat or on Threads or on Instagram, all of these places can be very positive or they can be really yucky. So talking with kids about your own experiences and asking them for the strategies that they use when they run into those challenges, that can be really important. We need to mentor our kids, not just lock them out or, you know, show them a skull and crossbones when they go click on and tell them that it's going to hurt them, because I think that can lead actually to sort of despair, and we need to be empowered.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's also in how it gets messaged. So our board op tells me that TikTok has been doing some of this messaging for a bit and that people make fun of it. So you do have to be careful in how you phrase it, because you're right. If it's just like this warning that pops up every hour that's like, this could be damaging to your mental health, you might just be like, okay, thanks.
Especially if that doesn't align with your experience. I think we need to be honest with kids about the research. You know, we know that, for example, losing sleep, whether it's to social media time, gaming, or anything else, is definitely risky for our mental and physical health. So messaging that's honest about sleep and saying, hey, you know, at these ages, this much sleep is recommended, that feels at least informative and science-based. If we just tell people, you're having a bad experience when you check this no matter what, if that's not true for me, right, again, if I go online every day and check my favorite YouTuber, and then I go out and jog because my YouTube channel tells me that jogging is good, or if I, you know, listen to my favorite podcast, you know, and it's like 1,000 hours outside, and then I go for a hike or whatever, that's not a bad experience, right? Or if I'm just seeing my friends, and that's where I connect with them before and after school every day. What we also need to do, though, is build spaces in our communities. Kids should have places to hang out. They should be able to hang out at the library. They should be able to hang out at the skate park. I think kids are over-policed. There are too few third spaces, you know, for kids to hang out outside of the home. And so it's no wonder that they're spending so much time hanging out on social media, because hanging out with your friends is really a developmental imperative for adolescents. So we need to create, if we want to see kids have more balanced use with social versus in person, we need to make places where they can hang out in person.
You know, Murthy also wrote that he wants to restrict the use of certain features like push notifications, autoplay, infinite scroll, some of the things that like make it so easy to look up and be like, oh my goodness, it's been an hour. What did I just spend my life doing? So what do you make of the idea of restricting some of those things, particularly for minors?
I think the idea of having, that he also calls for, is having the media companies share their health information that they get, and be able to, you know, for researchers like all of us to be able to use that, for the research community to have get our hands on it, we would love that. And I think in general, for all of us, social media should look at, you know, the company should look at how can we make our features less problematic. Like the Snapchat maps can make kids feel really left out, and they're a safety issue, frankly. I don't want my kid disclosing his location all over the place. I think that's a safety issue. So I think we really need to look at the apps, you know, the affordances of these apps. And we also need the apps to be more responsive. When parents call to report bullying, when school districts reach out and say there's an impersonation account where people are being targeted or bad things are happening, a lot of times these companies don't respond quickly. It's very hard to get a human at these mega companies to even call you back or respond to your complaints. So I think the companies need to be much more responsive. And if they can make, the problem is, of course, they want their products to grow, and they grow when we have things like the like button that manipulate our emotions. But yes, I think being responsible about manipulating conversations, about things like the filter bubble that we've known about for years, where we're all getting information that is algorithmically tuned to us. And a lot of the state legislation and proposed national legislation about kids and social media is about pushing back on that spying algorithm. And I'd like to see more privacy for all of us. I'd like to see less personal information getting auto-shared, and the defaults on these apps not to be things like sharing location and other user data. I think that's really important. So I think we need to collectively push back on the apps. And what I worry about with the labels is, does that let the apps off the hook? You know, if we say it's toxic, then they can be like, well, we can do whatever we want because you said it was bad on the label. So now we can really make it bad.
That is a good question. You know, I'm not really sure how TikTok would function without being able to build you a custom FYP, though. It kind of, right? TikTok, more than any other social media, really thrives on, like, I learn what you want, and then I give you what you want.
100%. 100%. And that is how they curate your feed. And kids did tell me TikTok was the most frequently quit app. When I was interviewing kids for Growing Up in Public, I had the most teenagers say I had to take TikTok off my phone so I could study and focus on other things because it was so good at figuring out what I wanted to see, even better than YouTube, that I really did need to take a break from it. I love to see teenagers making those decisions themselves, though. When we get into playing cop with teenagers and we get into those power struggles, we always lose, right? And then for some kids, it's also like, oh, you're going to build a wall? How high is the wall? How many minutes will it take me to scale the wall? There's videos all over YouTube teaching kids how to get around the parental controls on phones. And so I think when we focus on external control versus digital wellness teaching and mental health support in schools and in communities, we're doing the wrong thing, right?
That
Because
was
kids don't
Deborah
respond well to
Heitner,
being controlled.
author and social media educator. Thank you so much for your time today.